Hello and welcome to the podcast of Renew Lehigh Valley's Brown Bag Discussion Series. I'm Stephen Bliss, Executive Director of Renew Lehigh Valley, and this is the recording of the January 2010 session of our Brown Bag Series. These Brown Bags are an ongoing set of informal discussions of issues related to urban revitalization, smart growth, and regional collaboration. This session featured Pennsylvania State Representative Bob Freeman providing a legislative preview for 2010. Representative Freeman discussed a number of pending bills at the state level on issues related to smart growth and regional collaboration. These bills address issues such as historic preservation, comprehensive planning, Main Street programs, and stormwater management. The session was held on Friday, January 22nd at the Victory Firehouse in South Bethlehem. We welcome your comments and input, so send your feedback to us at smartgrowth@renewlv.org. The session begins with some welcoming remarks from Renew Light Lehigh Valley co-chair Dina Zosky, followed by Representative Freeman's presentation. Thanks for listening.
Welcome. My name is Dina Zosky. I'm one of the co-chairs of Renew Lehigh Valley, along with Andy Daub. And I am pleased to be able to be here today to talk to you about our speaker who will be speaking shortly. This is the latest in Renew's Brown Bag sessions, which have been really very well attended, and we're really pleased about that because it gives the community an opportunity to dialogue with some of the leaders in our community about issues that Renew feels are very important and affecting the things that happen in our community every day. The series essentially aims to have the community engaged in issues related to urban revitalization, sustainability, regional cooperation and collaboration, to name just a few, the things that Renew focuses on via their initiatives in the community every day. Prior sessions focused on traditional neighborhood development, community transportation planning. Today we'll talk a lot about what's going on in Harrisburg and land development. And I'm so pleased to be able to introduce Representative Freeman, who is a blessing to our community and as it relates to land planning, really, in my view, one of the most knowledgeable we have. I should note that these sessions are recorded and they're made available via download at Renew's website, which is www.renewlv.org. So today we're looking at what's coming up in Harrisburg related to pending legislation for traditional neighborhood development, and I'll ask you if I'm missing anything here, regional comprehensive planning, stormwater management, very near and dear to my heart, historic preservation, and other things as it relates to land development. So it's my pleasure, actually, to introduce our speaker today, who is Representative Freeman. Renew is honored to have Representative Freeman on our Leadership Council. And as we have begun the dialogue as a subgroup and then bringing it into the Leadership Council as it relates to regional land development, regional land issues, and how we work with surrounding governments and community members on cohesive land use policies, having Representative Freeman on our Leadership Council is just vital. And so I'm going to start to embarrass you by talking a little bit about your background. So Representative Freeman was elected to the House of Representatives in 1982, served 6 2-year terms, and then after serving as Executive Director of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee and Executive Director of the Senate Local Government Committee, returned to the House and has since been reelected 6 times. During his 12 years in the House, Representative Freeman served as chairman of the House Select Committee on Land Use and Growth Management, and as well as was vital in revising the Municipal Planning Code and wrote the traditional neighborhood development section of the MPC, which is amazing, especially as it relates to revitalization of our core communities. He also authored the Elm Street Program designed to revitalize older residential neighborhoods, and that speaks a little bit to the historical preservation item today. In recognition of his work on behalf of land use policies, environmental protection, smart growth, and historical preservation, Representative Freeman received the 10,000 Friends of Pennsylvania Public Official Smart Growth Visionary Award for 2009 and Pennsylvania Leadership in State Government and State Issues Award also in 2009. Representative Freeman is a native of Easton, graduate from Easton High School, and holds bachelor's degree from Moravian College and master's degree from Lehigh University. And as on a personal note, he gives just about the best walking tour, smart growth walking tour of the city of Easton that you could possibly have. So I highly recommend that. So it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Dina. Thank you for that wonderful invitation. Wonderful overview of my background and introduction. I often feel when I get an introduction like that, I'm probably best just to sit down. I'm already ahead of the game, and, you know, why mar it by doing something wrong? It is a pleasure for me to be here to talk about some issues that are near and dear to my heart. As a legislator, I have focused, as you heard from my resume, on land use issues. By the way, can everyone hear me in the back? You okay? I often wonder why speakers do that, because if you can't hear me, you're not going to nod anyway. Land use issues have been a real primary focus of my legislative work, and I'm happy to update you on legislation that's pending in Harrisburg that deals with promoting urban revitalization, open space preservation, smart growth policies and strategies, and seeks to encourage regional collaboration on a whole host of local government issues. I do want to note, too, I think it's marvelous that they put a time clock up there. We really should have one of those in the House. It would really make debate go a lot quicker. We could go into sudden death overtime, and that's pretty much how we operate anyway, so not a bad idea. I'd also would be remiss if I didn't mention the fine work done by Renew Lehigh Valley. This organization has been extremely instrumental in raising visibility on land use issues, land use policies, new techniques to put in place more sustainable approaches to development, and has been in the forefront of revitalizing our urban core areas here in the Lehigh Valley. So I appreciate the work done by Renew. In terms of land use issues, let me just begin by talking about the nature of them. I know for a lot of folks, not this crowd, because you obviously are interested enough to disrupt your Friday lunchtime to come and hear me speak, but for a lot of folks, it's a topic that just doesn't resonate. People might feel and understand land use issues on a gut level. When that Walmart comes into their neighborhood and what used to be a farm field is now an ocean of parking lot and a traffic nightmare, or when people see a wonderful historic building torn down and a one-story suburban-style building built in an urban form or in an urban area that doesn't fit the urban form, they know instinctively that something is wrong. But on the whole, land use issues, particularly when you get bogged down in the nitty-gritty of zoning and comprehensive plans and saldos, tend to be one of those issues that political commentator Jeff Greenfield referred to as MEGOs, M-E-G-O's, my eyes glaze over. So I will not be offended if in the course of my comments you guys start to glaze over. I'm used to it, trust me. For many years I'd go to cocktail parties and tell people I was working on comprehensive land use planning and see them desperately try and get away from me in conversation to check out the punch bowl or see what kind of dip was on the table. So, but despite the tendency to have these issues perceived as dry, they actually are extremely important and really are very fundamental to the overall operating of our society and to how our society develops, what kind of culture we become. There's a great quote by Winston Churchill I've used thousands of times, so if I see people lip-syncing in the audience, I'll understand. But Churchill once observed that we shape our buildings. Once they're built, they shape us. And the same is true of the pattern of development we choose to embrace. You get a different type of culture, a different type of society, based upon what particular pattern you choose. And design does make a difference. How you lay out your streets, how your buildings relate to the street, how you preserve or don't preserve your open space, all of that affects our quality of life and touches on a whole array of issues beyond simple design as well. Issues such as impacts on the environment, issues such as impacts on water quality, our carbon footprint, how much energy we use, and whether we are capable of creating a true and very genuine sense of community. Design can either hinder or help the ability to people feel a sense of connectivity and to create an almost invisible but very important foundation of how people relate to each other, interact with each other, and pull together to better the nature of their community. So these are very critical issues, and trying to promote a more thoughtful, smart growth approach to this public policy array of issues is very important. Let me give you an overview of some of the bills that are pending, what their status is, what their provisions are. One of the bills that I am prime sponsor of is House Bill 42. That is a bill aimed to try and promote urban revitalization by dealing with historic properties. The legislation would be known as the Historic Preservation Incentive Act. And if you think about the many assets that our older communities have, by far one of the greatest assets really is their older buildings. It's almost impossible to duplicate the kind of architecture that exists in many of our cities and small boroughs. Many of them were built during the zenith of outstanding public architecture, but also private architecture. And so in order to market those communities for revitalization, trying to promote a good preservation of historic architecture and trying to renovate that architecture to a fine standard is a critical component in urban revitalization. House Bill 42 would seek to stabilize neighborhoods and encourage historic renovation and economic development by providing grants and tax credits to individuals who would take a historic property and revitalize it, or renovate it, I should say, and bring it up to the historic standards required by the Department of the Interior. Under the bill, there would be grant money set aside through DCED, the Department of Community and Economic Development, to provide up to $15,000 to homeowners who own a historic structure and renovate it to bring it back to its historic, pristine look. They could not get more than 70% of the cost of the project with a maximum of $15,000. But as you renovate an old building, that $15,000 can be quite important. They must live in the building for at least a five-year period. We don't want it just to be a sort of a flipping of properties. We want it to be something that makes a difference in those neighborhoods. And priority is given to those historic homes that exist in an Elm Street community, a Main Street community, an enterprise zone, or where there's a local historic district. We recognize those communities are already focusing on those vital revitalization efforts. Another component of House Bill 42 is to create a corporate tax credit, a sum of money up to $10 million a year. No single project could exceed more than $500,000, and the project could only utilize tax credits for up to 25% of its renovation costs. But the interesting feature about this is it injects into the historic preservation effort the idea of revitalizing and bringing up to historic standards many of our commercial buildings, which are historic and worth saving in their own right. The bill was reported out of my committee last, I chair the House Local Government Committee, came out of my committee last year, is currently in the Senate Community Economic and Recreational Development Committee, and we're hoping to convince the chairman to send it to the floor. One of the sticking points is the funding source. You all know we went through a very rough budget season. The economy is still shaky, and that means revenues for state government are down as well. However, the idea was to utilize funding through the Environmental Stewardship Fund for this program. That was always envisioned as a component part of the Environmental Stewardship Fund, but when the rubber hit the road and they actually started allocating the money, they didn't consider historic tax credits. So we're still negotiating with the Senate to see if we can utilize that source, if not, find another source for the program. Another bill which deals with urban communities is House Bill 102, which I am also the prime sponsor of. And it just makes an adjustment to the Main Street program. How many people here are familiar with the Main Street program? Okay, there's a good number. And many of you probably have them in your community. Easton has a wonderful Main Street program. The Chamber operates a sort of circuit rider Main Street program that affects communities like Hellertown. And they can really go a long way towards revitalizing your commercial downtown district to making it look more appealing in terms of physical improvements, but also to market it and to brand it and to use it as a way to draw people back into the old downtowns. One of the shortcomings, however, of the Main Street program is it's basically a five-year program as far as the services of the Main Street manager go. After that period of time, state funding for the manager's salary evaporates, and it's up to the locals to find a way to fund it. Under my legislation, we would do something similar to what we did with the Elm Street program, which is to allow the Department of Community and Economic Development to, if they feel it's warranted, extend their involvement in a Main Street program for up to an additional 5 years. And in many communities, we found this particularly with Elm Street, but also with Main Street, it's sometimes critical to get beyond that sort of artificial barrier of 5 years. The worst thing a state program can do is get locals interested, get them involved, provide funding, provide a good manager on the ground to help them, and then right when they're starting to show promise, you pull the plug. So hopefully this program, if we can get the bill passed, it did pass the House, it's currently in the Senate, would go a long way towards evaluating what communities need a little more time to make their Main Street agenda a success. In the areas of planning, we have House Bill 842, introduced by a colleague of mine, Barb McElvain-Smith from Chester County, and it deals with the curative amendment issue. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. It's become a more common practice, particularly in the Southeast, but it's sort of seeping its way into developmental practices up here. What has happened is that a number of developers have challenged existing zoning ordinances as not meeting the standard required by court decision to zone for every conceivable use. If you zone in Pennsylvania, you must zone for every conceivable use. That's court decisions have reaffirmed that. And it's sort of in keeping in some respects with the Mount Laurel decision, which dealt with housing in New Jersey. But in the Pennsylvania case, it went far beyond that and said that you have to zone for every conceivable use. So you've got to find a place in your community for a Walmart. You've got to find your place in your community for a landfill or an airport. There's got to be some sort of receiving area. As you can well imagine, this is one of those cases where the courts disconnect with reality. I don't know where Tadami Borough would put their airport if they even had the available land. But unfortunately, that's the way the courts have interpreted zoning in Pennsylvania. One of the problems with that, it is, has served as a tool by many developers to come into a community and bust a zoning ordinance. A zoning ordinance might not have all the uses and precisely the percentages they should for an adequate zoning ordinance out of certain realities on the ground, but also maybe out of certain desires by the community to build something else. The available land might be built out in the particular type of development the developer is looking to create. And what has happened in a lot of communities in the Southeast in particular is a development will come in, say, you know, I want to put in, say, a trailer park, and you don't have enough land. And they'll use that as a ruse to bust the zoning ordinance. And once the zoning ordinance is busted, there's very little protection by the community as to what gets developed. So then the developer goes into the back room with the township supervisors, and they say, look, you know, I really don't want to build a mobile home park, but I do want to build maybe single-family homes on quarter-acre lots. And can you abide by this? We'll cut a deal. Once they lost the protection of the zoning, their leverage to try and create proper planning kind of goes out the window. Under Barb's bill, House Bill 842, we would allow for the municipality to correct the problems posed by a curative challenge. When a decision is rendered by a Pennsylvania court, appellate court on a curative challenge, it sort of stops the clock and says, okay, let us, the elected body, correct the error that the court seems to think we have and to redraft the zoning ordinance so that we can get the challenge behind us and ensure that the community still has its proper protection of zoning. It's a common sense proposal, but it's been tough getting that moving. We got it out of the House, and it's currently in the Senate Local Government Committee. Another proposal which deals with the traditional neighborhood development issue that Dina referenced is House Bill 1609, another bill that I'm the prime sponsor of. By way of background, traditional neighborhood development is a wonderful alternative to the all-too-common pattern of sprawl that we witness in our suburban communities. We have pretty much followed one particular type of development pattern since the end of World War II, and that's the low-density sprawling development that occurs in so many of our townships outside of cities. That low density makes all the inhabitants overly dependent on the automobile. It tends to adhere to a single-use zoning approach to development, which doesn't allow for the kind of natural mixing of uses that can create a sense of community, a sense of place, and create wonderful encounters by neighbors that gets people to know who their neighbors are. The end result tends to be that you have an overabundance of use of automobiles, which affects your environmental quality, drives people crazy as they commute 40 minutes one way to work every day, and can really cause some tremendous quality of life problems. The alternative is something called traditional neighborhood development. And it harkens back to the pre-World War II pattern of when you develop, to develop along traditional towns, allow for mixed use to accommodate all housing ranges, allow for mixed use of uses that are compatible. Why can't there be a coffee shop in a residential neighborhood? Great gathering spot for neighbors. Why can't there be a nice little luncheonette where people can grab a bite or a convenience grocery store? If you design it properly, and design really is the key, it can be extremely compatible with the residential neighborhood or subdivision. But we have to get beyond the single-use zoning mindset to achieve that. Back in 2000, I was able to amend TND language into the MPC as part of Act 68. And so we have had that provision in our municipality's planning code for 10 years now. The problem was, back in 2000, we had to compromise with the Home Builders Association, who didn't want it to be used as an outright use when it came to new development. They were willing to accept it as an outgrowth of existing development or as sort of urban infill, but they were leery about allowing a municipality to designate a TND area within a community as new development. So I introduced House Bill 1609, which in essence would allow municipalities the power to designate areas of their community for outright TND designation. This holds some tremendous promise, particularly for those municipalities that are in the path of development, that might have villages that can already serve as sort of a urban core or a town core within their community. And by working through a TND approach to zoning, they could build out from that, retain the sort of historic look of that cluster village, and in the process, preserve a lot of land for open space by using a more clustered approach to the TND mechanism. That bill passed in the House. It passed in the Senate Local Government Committee and is actually on the Senate calendar for a vote, so hopefully they'll take that up. I think also it really addresses one of the demographic changes we're seeing in home ownership. You know, post-World War II suburbia was built sort of for an Ozzie and Harriet model. You know, two parents, 2.3 kids. I've never seen a 0.3 kid, but supposedly they exist. And the idea was to create a very safe, sort of prosperous environment in a green setting. And that was the model that we worked from through the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. But we have seen the shortcoming that comes with the sprawl problems associated with that particular model. The TND model offers a marvelous alternative and a greater diversity of options in terms of housing. We have become a very diverse demographic population. A lot of empty nesters, a lot of people with no kids, a lot of people who have different needs. And by adding flexibility to the zoning ordinance, we can allow people to access those housing options in new development as well as existing structures. And for those who sell real estate and those who build buildings, it's a great way to touch every price point in your housing mix. Less risk for your operation, particularly in a volatile economy. Another bill dealing with planning issues is House Bill 1754, introduced by Representative Grisella. And this is a basic common sense one, and I'm still not sure why it's taken so long to get it as far as we have. It did pass the House. It's currently in the Senate. It would require municipalities to notify school districts whenever development, residential development, has been approved. When new development's been approved for residential development, they simply advise the school district as to the number of units, the type of units. This allows the school district to be more proactive in their planning process. How will this impact our student population? How will this impact the need to deal with bus routes? How will this impact the need possibly for expanded physical plant of school facilities? So it's a good common sense approach, and we're hoping to move that at some point in this session as well. Another planning tool is contained in House Bill 1036, sponsored by Tom Houghton, a very bright up-and-coming member out of Chester County. This would amend the MPC to require comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances to be generally consistent. There is more or less a requirement now in the MPC, but it's rather weak. And townships have tended to be leery of requiring direct linkage and consistency out of fear that somehow if their comprehensive plan isn't fully reflected in their zoning ordinance, they could be challenged and there could be a whole lot of problems with dealing with permitting and whatnot. But if you stop and think about it, the comprehensive plan is the one document communities have to serve as a visioning document. You know, you should spend time and effort to do a good comprehensive plan. You should engage the citizens of the community because that document can tell you what kind of community do you want to be? What do you want this place to look like in 10, 20, or 30 years? And what amenities do you see as critical to your quality of life? So creating greater linkage between the comp plan and the zoning ordinance is critical in order to better guide the zoning ordinance along proper paths. And we are still working on language on that. There is language in the bill. But we are in negotiations with the Township Association to try and allay their concerns and find language that could still achieve the ends of the legislation. In terms of open space, Representative Craig Daly, now Judge Daly, he just got sworn in, or will be sworn in today, as a matter of fact, introduced House Bill 951. And basically, it just builds on past legislation which permitted municipalities to hold referendum to allow the citizens to determine whether they wanted a certain mix of taxes, whether it's the real estate tax or the income tax, to have money set aside that would be used for open space preservation, acquisition of open space land. That's been on the books a while. But the benefit of Judge Daly's bill is that it would allow a portion of that money to be used towards the planning process. When we passed the original legislation allowing those referendums for open space acquisition and preservation, we didn't consider that there are some extreme costs that go into putting together a good open space plan. So this would allow the municipalities to set aside some money for that purpose. In the area of regional cooperation, we have House Resolution 273, introduced by Representative John Yudichek. It's a concurrent resolution. It passed out of my committee. It's on the tabled calendar in the House and would require the passage in the Senate in order to go into effect. Basically, it would simply provide for the creation of a special study commission that would look at our system of local government here in Pennsylvania, make recommendations on how to improve upon that, and most importantly, make recommendations on how to facilitate greater collaboration and cooperation between municipal units of government, particularly as they pertain to land use issues, but the whole array of issues that confront municipalities in these tough fiscal times. Pennsylvania, as many of you know, have more numbers of municipal governments than any other state in the union, except for, I think, Illinois. We have over 2,500 municipalities. And when I teach a course on land use at Lehigh every spring, when I tell my students that, oh, yeah, we've got first-class townships, second-class townships, we've got boroughs, we've got cities of the first, second, third class, you could just see them just sort of spinning as they're trying to absorb all that. It's a very fragmented system. And while we cherish the ability to have local control, we can do a better job at fostering cooperation. And we're fortunate that a number of communities in our Lehigh Valley have already taken those steps. The Saucon Valley is a classic example. We have Jack Cahallan and Charlie Luther from Lower Saucon and Hellertown, and they've been in the forefront of trying to cooperate on planning issues and other issues, and I commend them for their work. But this commission hopefully would set out some recommendations on how to better improve that process. And finally, two other bills, and then I will open it to questions. I know when I start seeing heads nod and hit the person's chair in front of you, it's time to shut up. So, stormwater, which Dina referred to, is a very important issue in this Commonwealth and one that we don't adequately address. We currently have a Stormwater Act, Act 167 of 1978, and while it was well-intentioned, it has proven to be rather weak and very poor at creating requirements where counties actually follow through in terms of comprehensive stormwater management plans. There's not enough teeth in the bill, to tell you the truth. And few counties have actually complied with the original act. A number of municipalities still operate under Act 167, obviously, and that does somewhat of a decent job at dealing with stormwater within the confines of a parcel of development, say a subdivision. But it doesn't approach stormwater issues from a comprehensive standpoint, where you're actually dealing with the effects on neighboring property in a greater detail. You're looking downstream as to the impacts of stormwater, and doesn't give enough tools to better deal with remedial problems that have existed before Act 67 was in place. So to address that, I introduced House Bill 1390. I'm the prime sponsor. The original sponsor was Dave Stile, an outstanding member from Bucks County. I'm a Democrat. He's a Republican, but we collaborated on a lot of land use issues over the years, and he was just a wonderful person to work with. I was sorry to see him retire, but he really pressed me as a friend and said, you've got to take up this issue, and it's a good issue, so I was glad to take it up. If you don't deal properly with stormwater problems, you end up with a host of problems. Flooding, which we've seen in our Lehigh Valley. City of Easton has been hit numerous times by flooding problems, in part caused by poorly planned stormwater management and poorly planned development. We've lost our absorption areas as we've built over certain areas. Farm fields were great absorption areas, wetlands and the like. As development has continued at a rapid pace, you lose those natural absorption areas. You're creating more impervious surfaces with roads and parking lots. All of that contributes to a stormwater problem. And that problem can affect water quality, soil erosion, a whole host of problems. This bill would require counties to adopt a comprehensive stormwater management plan, identify existing problems, address remedial problems that were never fully addressed under 167, and begin to look at planning to deal with peak hour runoff, issues of volume and velocity in terms of runoff, and recommendations on how to retrofit systems that aren't adequate to dealing with stormwater. Under this legislation, there'd also be the option for counties and municipalities to join in creating an integrated water resource management plan. This plan would be actually a very extensive plan dealing with all water resources and wastewater resources within a region to try and really take a more comprehensive approach within a watershed as to how to deal with all of your resources. the importance of having that kind of optional plan in addition to just good policy on dealing with water matters is it would also put our communities and our regions in a much better position to deal with federal requirements that are coming down on how to deal with water and stormwater. So it really is a good piece of legislation. Finally, there is a provision in that bill that also would allow for the creation of stormwater management authorities so that you would have an entity that could float bonds, build the necessary infrastructure to deal and implement with the plans, taking it a step further. My final bill, and then I'll open it to questions because I realize we're still okay. Yeah, surprising. No overtime. Is a piece of legislation I introduced last session, which I am getting ready to reintroduce again. It deals with tax-exempt properties. Any of you who live in an older community, particularly one of the Lehigh Valley cities, realize how many tax-exempt properties actually exist within those borders. And while those institutions are wonderful assets in most cases, our colleges, our healthcare institutions, houses of worship, you name it, they really add to the quality of life of those communities, and that's a plus. The downside is they're tax-exempt. And the basic, most fundamental way of raising revenue at the municipal level is through the real estate tax. So if you have a critically high mass of tax-exempt properties, you're operating at a loss. You have an eroded tax base. You can't raise the level of revenue you need in order to provide essential municipal services. And too often, for a variety of reasons, a lot of our older communities are the ones that need the revenue in order to deal with more pressing problems, whether they be issues of blight, revitalization, crime, code enforcement, you name it. Many of those communities also have professional fire and police forces, and that takes a big chunk of the budget. So they are really fighting the battle with one hand tied behind their back because such a big portion of their community is tax exempt. And I'll give you an example. My hometown of Easton, 27% of the market assessed value of Easton is tax exempt. One out of four total volume of property is tax exempt. Try addressing the challenges of an urban area, knowing that you don't even have the kind of full base of tax base you need to raise the revenue to deal with issues of poverty, crime, and what have you. It's almost impossible. The reason our urban areas are failing is not because we don't have good people in positions in those communities, not because they're not trying, not because they don't work diligently to try and make their communities a better place. It's because they don't have the revenue streams they need. And I think we as a state have to step up to the plate and acknowledge the fact that the tax-exempt entities that exist in those communities are truly regional assets. They enhance the quality of life for an entire region. So why not have the state provide some measure of revenue sharing to compensate those communities that are burdened as the host municipality? So under my legislation, we would take the money that is raised through the current Johnstown flood tax that was enacted in 1936, it still exists, long after the Johnstown flood was addressed. Every time you buy a bottle of liquor or wine in the state store, there's an 18% tax that you don't even see on your receipt, which is from the Johnstown flood tax. Surprise! That goes into the general fund, and we have used it, and it's been very handy, particularly in these tough budget years. It creates about $250 million annually in revenue. My legislation would earmark that funding for compensating communities with high tax-exempt levels of property and would funnel that money back into those communities through a formula which says that if you have 15% or more tax-exempt property, you can draw down some dollars. We add in two safeguards to make sure that there's not a windfall for some communities. No community can get more than 10% of the fund. That's all the money being sucked up by Philadelphia. No community can get more than $100 per person in the community. That's to make sure that you're not funneling too much into some communities that probably don't need a huge amount of money because of a small population base. But with those caveats, it would be remarkable what we could provide to our communities. Allentown would realize over $6 million in revenue. Bethlehem would realize $3 million. Easton, $1.8 million. And the borough of Fountain Hill, where 40% of the assessed value is tax-exempt because of the presence of St. Luke's, would realize $461,000, which is substantial for a small borough. There's a real need for this. We have a number of communities that are falling into Act 47 fiscal distress. The Fiscal Distress Act targets those communities that just cannot make a go of it anymore. Their tax base is gone. They're in fiscal distress. If you look at the statistics in those communities, the vast majority of those Act 47 communities, And believe me, our own cities are on the watch list for those that status. The vast majority of those communities have tax-exempt levels of 20, 30, or 40%. So it's clear that one of the major contributing factors to their failure is just not enough of a tax base to deal with their needs as a municipality. Harrisburg, 48% of their property is tax-exempt. Johnstown, 48%. And the poster child, Gettysburg. Almost 80% of the assessed value of Gettysburg is tax-exempt. You have the battlefield, you have the hospital, you have the courthouse, you have the municipal buildings, you have the college. I was surprised to learn a couple last session when we had hearings down there. The mayor of Gettysburg, and mayor down there is a part-time job, it's a borough. The mayor, who has a modest, regular residential home, he pays more in real estate tax in the borough of Gettysburg than the Walmart does in the neighboring township, which has an extremely low millage rate because they have a broad tax base. There's something wrong when that's the result. So hopefully this legislation, we're working on a redraft. We hope to reintroduce it and get it in place in order to really shore up the fiscal picture for a lot of our boroughs and cities, but even some townships that have high tax-exempt properties. With that, I thank you for your patience on these topics. I realize I went through a whole laundry list, and you were very good. No one fell asleep. So I'd be happy to open the floor to questions on this legislation or other planning and smart growth issues. Well, the bill number last session was 2018. We're redrafting it, so it doesn't have an official number yet. It'll be posted once we introduce it. Yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, there is a different dynamic that comes into play with land use issues. I have found a tremendous common ground between suburban southeastern Republicans and urban Democrats on these issues because the scope of the issue affects both types of communities. You want to revitalize the urban core. You want to maintain open space and farmland and townships where development might be kind of overtaking that community. So there is a great opportunity to form coalitions. And I've worked very closely with a number of Republicans from the suburban Southeast. Dave Stile was one of them. Chris Ross is another member. There's others that I work with because they recognize the need for this legislation. It's interesting. Instead of a partisan Democrat-Republican dynamic, you end up more with suburban Republicans and urban Democrats and environmentalists on one side. And then on the other side, it tends to be those more conservative Republicans who don't want to put in any place any kind of tools for local government to better manage growth. They want to have a sort of a free rein approach to how developers approach a community. And those members of the Democratic Party who come from the West who don't have sprawl problems and are anxious for any kind of development. They don't care what it is. It can be a box. As long as the box is a parking lot and people go in and out of it, they're happy. They just are so hungry for development. So it creates a different coalition of groups on the issue. No, not currently. I'm in the process of redrafting, and we're hoping to reintroduce it in about a month or so if we can. Yeah. Okay, then you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. I mean, St. Luke's is a great asset, but it really is a regional asset. You guys shouldn't have to deal with the eroded tax base as a result of having it there. Any other questions? Sure, in the back. Yeah. That's a very good question. I'm trying to remember what – I don't think we referenced it in the legislation because we use the Federal Department of Interior standards. So whatever they use as their guideline for historic structures is how we go by. Obviously, something that's on the National Register would qualify as a structure. Yeah, but we tend to follow the guidelines set down by the Department of the Interior in that legislation. But good question. Any other – 50 years? Okay. 50 years or more. Yeah. So someday, some of that schlocky suburban architecture will be historic. It's it's already kind of kitschy in some ways. Yeah, so. Sure. Yeah, that's a concern for a number of us. In fact, I and a number of other legislators who banded together when that issue arose, we started to call ourselves the Green Dogs as an alternative to the Blue Dogs. Everything's color-coded now in Harrisburg. So. We actually were able to get the Senate to back off of a more extensive leasing of state forest land. The original proposal by the Senate would have put a lot of acreage, more acreage than currently is, under leasing. So we constricted it quite a bit in order to deal with the budget problems. We are now in the process of trying to prevent put in place a moratorium on further state forest land beyond the original agreement, because that's being eyed again also. Another component part of that is the need for the state to put in place a severance tax. A number of states that have natural resources impose severance taxes to get their share of revenue from the extraction of those minerals or items like natural gas. And it's very critical to the budgets of those states. It also allows those states to direct some of those funds back into the communities that have been affected. Their road systems obviously get beat up by all the trucks that are there to deal with the processing of extraction. And also put it back into environmental programs through the Environmental Stewardship Fund. So I'm hoping in this session that we actually take up a severance tax, one as a means to find a revenue source that will help us with our current fiscal problems, but two, to provide some of the resources we need to deal with environmental issues and community issues as well. Well, there actually is a gas lease fund that is operated by DCNR for extraction of natural gas on state land. That's where the money's supposed to go. It was diverted this last budget time just to fill a hole in the budget, but will be where the money comes from for any future leasing that might occur in the future. And some of the proposals have dealt with the issue of how you put money aside for that, or at least divert it into something like the Environmental Stewardship Fund, which then can use it for a variety of environmental programs. So, well, I'm not a lawyer. I try and dress like one at every opportunity, but I'm not an attorney. So that really would be a matter for the solicitor to look at. But I would assume, just speaking from a lawmaker's perspective, that since those funds were raised under legislation specifically geared towards referendum to create a funding source for open space, it would be very difficult to divert them into another source. And I think they'd be on very shaky legal ground to try and take monies that were the result of a referendum specifically for open space and divert it. Now, what they might do is become very clever and divert some of that into their parks program so they can take money out of the parks program and divert it elsewhere. But, you know, sorry, that's the, my favorite quote on legislation was by Bismarck. Those who love laws and sausages shouldn't see how either are made. You know, it's a grisly process. So. Yours, how are you? Yeah, the fracking process, which uses a lot of water resources. Mm-hmm. Well, DEP does feel there can be safe ways of extracting, and it's going to happen. There's going to be extraction. It's too huge of an energy resources. But I think the key issue is environmentally sensitive areas, like our state forests. We have to be extremely careful, and that's why I think we need a moratorium on drilling in state forests beyond the original agreement. There's already extraction going on throughout the Marcellus Shale in the northern tier. But you're right, there are issues that have to be addressed in terms of water quality, in terms of the extraction process, and in terms of the impact on the environment. Those all have to be addressed. So. You're just pounding the wall or you have your hand? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. That's a good question. I'll tell you, I've been very impressed with the guys in the Saucon Valley. Charlie and Jack are two outstanding managers. They really are. They're, in my mind, they're kind of the epitome of what a municipal manager should be. They both are outstanding, and I mean that sincerely. And they have taken a community that was always at odds. If anyone knows the history of the Saucon Valley, there was always sort of a deep suspicion between Lower Saucon and Hellertown. I think it started over the merging of the school districts back in the 60s. But for years, you know, I remember when I first started representing that area, I would, you know, raise issues of collaboration, and you'd see people bristle. It was, you know, the Serbs and the Croats have nothing over, you know, the Saucon Valley. But they have done an outstanding job of smoothing that over, of getting policymakers in those communities and the citizens at large to realize that, yes, there is more in common. And they've done a great job of advancing the Act 167 Multi-Municipal Comprehensive Plan process. They're looking at other ways to collaborate on recreation issues and a whole host of other issues. So I would hold them out as one of the better examples here in the Lehigh Valley of cooperative effort and of taking an approach of being pragmatic. You know, it seems that in an age where the ideological lines tend to be drawn so clearly, whether it's by parties or by interest groups, it's refreshing to see local government folks say, look, we've got issues we have to deal with, and we've got to be grown-ups, and we've got to say, how's the best way of delivering the service or addressing this concern or putting in place better planning. So I think that approach in the Saucon Valley is really a fine example. And I think they're available for a consultation fee, too. So. No, in fact, that's one of the sticking points. We did make it clear through some amendments that counties do not have to proceed until the state can pony up their share of grant money for the planning process. The counties are very leery, obviously, of another mandate being handed to them. And we recognize that. And so we amended the bill to say that they don't have to proceed with the comprehensive plan until the state share is there. And given the current budget, it won't be there this year, but we're hoping to get it back into that budget next year. In terms of the actual implementation side of things, the building of the infrastructure, if you go the route of having authorities, you would then have the ability to float bonds and to charge fees that could pay down the debt service. And that's been used in a whole host of infrastructure projects by municipalities for eons. So that's probably the best way to approach it. Yeah, there's nothing. No, there's nothing to preclude tapping into both. And in fact, I think what would enhance efforts at historic renovation is that you would have a state equivalent of a grant program, grant for residential, credit for commercial. But it would allow those projects to have more to offer in terms of a developer who wants to turn those, or a homeowner who wants to obviously renovate to a historic standard. There's about, I think, a dozen states that have similar grant and credit programs as envisioned in my bill, House Bill 42. And it's another tool, really. The other thing, too, is, you know, it's a lot of people in the construction business are really hurting. The economy is flatlined. They're finding a tough time of it. Wouldn't it be marvelous to get those talented folks to work on something that's not going to gobble up more farmland, that'll revitalize our urban communities? And we can do that by incentivizing those renovations and put a lot of those people back to work and just really create some economic buzz in our cities and boroughs. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's an important linkage in dealing with all land use issues. Transportation systems guide paths of development. They really do. And all you have to do is look at the history of the railroads, the history of the interstate highway system. You can see a pattern that was developed out of those transportation modes. The issue of tolling I-80 really is the sticking point. We need revenue. There is not the political will to raise the gas tax, particularly during a recession. So that holds the best opportunity for us to be able to develop some level of resource to tackle some of those issues. Under the act that was originally passed, even without the I-80 tolling, we are now diverting some turnpike funds from the Pennsylvania Turnpike into sustaining mass transit, into other transportation projects. So there is a bit of an infusion of more resources for those worthy projects. I know Renew Lehigh Valley has been a real leader in trying to promote rail service, and I'm a big fan of reestablishing rail service. I think that would be a dynamic consequence for the Lehigh Valley. I think if we get train service back into Easton, Bethlehem, and Allentown, into New York, and down into Philadelphia, the potential for revitalizing our urban cores is amazing. Property which has limited value would just take off because of the proximity to those stations. The possibility of back office space for major corporate operations in eastern New Jersey and Manhattan would be wonderful. And the residential potential that would then serve to create a customer base for the downtown stores. That's the linkage we need. We have to beef up that residential base in the downtowns in order to get the commercial districts revived and stable. So I think train service is an integral part of that process. And I'm hoping to work with you. I'm sorry that Paul Maron is now in Spain as opposed to here, but he led the way, and I think we can follow up on that. Well, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, court decisions have ruled that if you zone, and zoning is one of your few legal protections in a community as far as patterns of development, if you zone, you must zone for every conceivable use. It's an absurd standard in many regards, but that's the law of the land based on court decisions. One way to get around that, however, is to enter into the Act 67 plans that we provided for back in 2000. Those plans allow for multi-municipal comprehensive planning. And if you join into a multi-municipal comprehensive plan and provide for every conceivable use in a broader region, all the component municipalities that make up that plan, then every individual municipality does not necessarily have to address all uses within their own borders, provided it's taken care of somewhere within the broader region of the Act 67 plan. So it's a marvelous way of kind of getting at that issue of having to deal with every conceivable use. You still have to have some measure of development to that any use, but you can better control where it goes, make sure it makes more sense where it is. And it gives communities the opportunity through the negotiating process of an Act 67 plan to really determine what kind of trade-offs they want. What do you need for your community? What do I need for mine? How can we help each other? How can we get there? So the Act 67 planning process, I think, is our best bet to find an alternative path to the court decisions. They have to, if they zone, they have to zone for every conceivable use. If they want to get beyond that standard, they have to join with their neighbors in a joint comprehensive plan. And then the next step after you have an Act 67 plan really is to realign your individual zoning ordinances to reflect that plan. Once you do that, then you can say no in certain areas because you're dealing more from a regional perspective. And to tell you the truth, that makes far more sense. So many of the uses that municipalities are called upon to deal with have a more regional scope to them as opposed to a localized scope. And the Act 67 plans can afford that opportunity. Peter? Well, with legislation, the devil is always in the details. and that's where community and citizen involvement makes all the difference in the world. As we deal with legislation, believe me, I've been frustrated with the kind of battles I've had to go through over my years of service. And it helps if you have grassroots support backing you up, letting other legislators know that, yes, in fact, this is an important issue for our community. We don't want to leave it to a decision just by the various interest groups who have the clout at the table. That's critical. That really is. Well, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I think there will be some direction of resources to expanding aspects of 22 as a corridor, but you've got to be careful about expanding it too far because you then create induced traffic. Where the more available road you make, the more traffic you attract. And you'll find out that that road quickly gets overcrowded even after you've made the expansion. I remember when the debate was raging over whether to build the southern corridor to 78. Everyone said, oh, I'll take the trucks off of 22. They're still on 22 because they still have to make deliveries in the 22 corridor. It'll reduce traffic congestion. Well, it didn't reduce traffic congestion. We ended up drawing more traffic into our valley because now you had two roads in order to come in. So while there is a need to address certain aspects of the 22 corridor to deal with transportation needs and expand in certain areas, I think it's got to be a more holistic approach to the transportation issue. Improve 22 where you can at a cost-effective way. Explore other alternative routes. This is going way back. I'm showing my age as a policymaker. The Lawrence Street Expressway project, which was envisioned years ago to link downtown Southside Bethlehem with downtown Allentown, never came to fruition, even though there is a corridor which would have limited development opportunity because of the topography of that area. That's another way to create sort of a spur route between the two cities. Light rail holds tremendous opportunities. I talked about how wonderful it would be if we put light rail back into the Lehigh Valley. It was here in the beginning of the 20th century. If we could re-establish light rail, we could easily provide alternative modes of transportation between the three cities and into high population areas and attractions like the airport or the Lehigh Valley Mall, and make our bus system far more effective. LANT is a great system, and they do a decent job considering their limited resources. But anyone who has traveled LANTA knows that the trips can be overly long because they're winding through a long route. If you have light rail serving as the spine of your transportation, public transportation system, you can then make your bus systems a little more neighborhood-based that feed into the line, and the line serves to give you the express access you want. A light rail line between Easton and Allentown could make the time in 20 minutes because it would have its own right-of-way. These are considerations that should be part of the planning process and our transportation options as we proceed as a region, and really need to be there not only because it makes sense from a transportation standpoint, but just because of all the other environmental and energy considerations we're going to be confronting in the decades ahead. We can't keep building along a 1950s model of development and not expect negative consequences. We have to provide more options, I think, for people in terms of transportation. Any other questions? Sure. I think it's always important to contact your legislators, either in the House or the Senate, and particularly from my standpoint, the Senate. I've got good working relationships with the Senate chairman of the local government committee, and he has advanced a couple of our bills. But it's always pulling teeth to get House measures moving through the Senate. There's an old joke that we tell in the House where if you go to a community dinner and they're serving family style, never sit next to a senator because they'll never pass anything a House member wants. You'll starve to death, you know. So it's always important to try and work on the Senate if we can. And there's some senators who I think are very sympathetic to the kind of legislation I've talked about, particularly those from the Southeast and from the Lehigh Valley. But it's a matter of getting it on the radar screen and making them realize it's a priority for their constituents. With that, I thank you for your patience, and I hope it's been informative.
I just have a couple of closing remarks. I just want to thank again Representative Freeman for spending time with us today. It's greatly appreciated on behalf of everyone at Renew. I want to thank everybody for coming. Another great event, a good turnout. I want to remind everybody if they want to put themselves on the sign-up sheet, it's where, Stephen, in the back? So you can get information about upcoming events. If you want to check out what we're doing for future brown bags, you can go to smartgrowth@renewlv.org. And a special thanks to the staff and the partners of Originate Ventures for hosting us, especially Shannon Morin, who's the business administrator in a repurposed building, which is wonderful. So I want to thank you folks for having us at this wonderful event. So thank you, everybody, for coming. Enjoy your weekend, and we look forward to seeing you at some future brown bags. Thanks.